Michael Knowles from The Daily Wire is with me. You can find his show at dailywire.com. Michael, let's talk about your conversion to Catholicism. You studied at Yale, and you were not Catholic when you went there. Walk us through your faith journey and what kind of transformed this for you.
Sure. I mean, I suppose properly you would call it a reversion, because I was a cradle Catholic, but I fell away from the faith by age 13. That was the time at which there was a lot of the new atheists, you know, Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and those guys, and that their arguments are not very good arguments, but they appeal to a 13-year-old boy. So I was taken with them. This was also during the time of the sex crisis in the church, and I also, you know, I take full responsibility for my falling away from the church. I think it was the hubris of a teenage boy. But I will say, too, that the weak liturgies, the sort of effeminate liturgies that I was raised with as the only option, you know, these sort of sappy hymns from the 70s, you know, these songs that weren't even cool 50 years ago, and the felt banners and all that sort of saccharine sentimentality, it doesn't really give people, especially boys, something to hold on to, something to understand that there's a real order and a beauty and an intellectual heft. So I make it to Yale as an atheist, and I noticed all the people were very smart, most of them atheists, but the very smartest people were Christian, and the smartest of them were more traditional. You know, they were either high church Anglican or Catholic, or on their way to becoming Catholic. And so I was convinced intellectually that God exists by a roommate of mine who presented me with one of the arguments, Saint Anselm's ontological argument for God. Mm. And, you know, that's not an argument that convinces a lot of people, but it really got me. I found it to be a charming argument. And then I read more. You know, I read C.S. Lewis. I encountered the Thomistic arguments for God. And I just thought about it. And it was this long process of getting myself over the intellectual hurdle, because our whole culture tells us that if you believe in God, you're some kind of dummy, even though, you know, I don't think anyone would call Thomas Aquinas a dummy, but that's how it's been presented to us. And only at that point, Hemingway says, things happen gradually, then suddenly. This was probably just after I'd left Yale. I don't know, it was about 22, 23. Only after that intellectual reversion, that understanding, then the more spiritual elements really began to hit me. And that process, you know, I guess about 23 until the present, has only deepened. That's something that's so nice about the faith, is, you know, as my priest, Father Rutler, says, quoting Dr. Johnson, shallows are clear, and shallow thinking is clear, but deep things are profound. They're a little murky, and so you kind of can delve those depths, and there's no end to it, because we could never comprehend the faith. It's in its very nature, it's incomprehensible.
Right. That's Michael Knowles of The Daily Wire. You're listening to Trending with Timory. Michael, it reminds me, a couple of weeks ago, I had Helen Alvarez with me, and we were talking about law students right now, and kind of what's the problem that so many law students can't see truth, they can't come to a basic understanding of God. And she really said, I think it's just time. They don't have time to just sit and think, or they don't take the time about these arguments. And so I think it's very profound. You know, your experience there at Yale, I remember you commenting when you were on the show before that you were kind of looking at, like, who are the smart people? Who are the people I'm engaging with on campus, and there were people of faith.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And also the world, you know, if you have a materialist, secular, liberal, you know, whatever phrase you want, worldview, it's seductive, but the world doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, you can't really make sense of your deepest longings, your loves, your joys, your hopes, your own sense of yourself, the reason you're here. I mean, it sort of transforms all of existence into an ironic, cruel joke. And then when you see the world through the lens of the faith, everything begins to make sense. I mean, you know, Catholicism is so rich in symbols that we recognize that this material that we're touching, that's all around us, has a spiritual and a metaphysical significance as well. And it just, either the world is one cruel joke and we're wrong about everything and we can't even rely on our own faculties of reason, at which point, you know, who cares? Or this makes sense. And I think if young people were given the time and maybe the encouragement to think on these eternal questions instead of remaining perpetually agitated with whatever the latest politics news is or whatever the latest technology is, if they were able to really contemplate those questions, even for a few hours, I think they would find that modern, secular modernity just doesn't suffice. It doesn't answer those questions. It doesn't satisfy.
And that's the beast of the news cycle right now with the coronavirus. You'd think that this was our time to pull back, to pause, to rest, to kind of think about those things right. We haven't had time to think about. But instead, we're being consumed by the news cycle. Listen, Michael, I have another question for you. You mentioned earlier kind of this effeminacy of the liturgy, the Catholic liturgy, and how it was a turnoff for you, you know, when you were a young boy. And I'm going to get in trouble here because last time you and I spoke about this, we had a lot of pushback. But there's such value to what you're having to say. There's so many men who are saying church does not engage me. And I have to tell you, and I'm going to get myself in trouble here. There are times where I will go to a certain church or I'm traveling and I cannot pray because I am having to plug my ears because of the songs that are being sung that are so off-key, are so awfully written, bad theology, that I'm more angry and frustrated and distracted by the song. And it's unfortunate because good music, good, beautiful liturgical music elevates the soul and allows for contemplation rather than distraction.
Of course. I mean, the whole premise of these sappy, frequently heretical songs like Eagle's Wings and songs like that, the whole idea was that they're going to be hip and cool and bring the youths back to the church. And that simply doesn't happen. You know, when you go into these more hippy-dippy kind of liturgies, the median age is about 107. And when you go into a traditional Latin Mass, which, you know, I only became available even when I turned, I guess, 16, 17, and I had never been raised with it. When you go to a traditional Latin Mass, the median age is about 22, and somehow they all have 10 kids. I don't know how that is, you know. That's where the life is. That's where the growth is. That's where the vibrancy is. And so I do wish that some of the people who were so interested in bringing the youths back to the church would actually listen to those youths. You know, I mentioned the great Father Rutler earlier. He had a wonderful line about how some perhaps well-intentioned but misguided priests will, you know, turn the modern Mass into a sort of performance, like ham actors in a dying vaudeville show, to use his phrase. When we realize, when we attend a more traditional liturgy, the priest is facing ad orientem, that he's leading us in a real prayer, in a real sacrifice. And he's not merely putting on a show so that we can be entertained for an hour before we go to brunch. You know, as this world is so rich in symbolism, then all these moments of the Mass, these symbols really matter. And it would seem to me, just from anecdotally, from my own experience and talking to many other young people, that they find that richness so much more in the traditional forms of liturgy and in the traditional Latin Mass.
And it's fascinating because even places where, let's say, they don't have the Latin Mass, but what we're seeing is there's an increase in a return to chant. There's an increase in a return to the smells, the bells, and all of these elements. The reverence is palpable. I mean, people, young people, and we're talking about young people because young people haven't seen the reverence of the liturgy. Even 20 years ago in my own childhood, there was deeper reverence, silence before Mass, people praying after Mass. I mean, if you've grown up in the last 15, 20 years, I mean, that's gone away. And so I hear a lot of people say, well, I grew up with kind of some of this hippiness. I've grown up with, you know, the music that we're used to. But sometimes when that foundation hasn't been kind of set for a lot of people, they really are struggling. And I get it.
Of course. And there, I mean, I think you've touched on a great point here, which is that this is not simply a battle between the Tridentine Mass and the Mass of Paul VI, the Novus Ordo. There can be a reverent Novus Ordo. It's just, unfortunately, there have been so many liturgical abuses over the past 50 years that people forget that. They think that the new Mass is sort of intrinsically irreverent, but it doesn't have to be. If you just bring back altar rails, if you bring back receiving the Eucharist on the tongue, if you bring back some chanting, if you bring back some smells and bells, if you simply brought back the priest facing ad orientem, just that change alone would so radically alter people's perspectives and put it quite literally in the right direction.